Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Christogenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, July 24th, 2026. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening, we are going to present the third portion of our highlights in Exodus. I'm trying not to number these podcasts in Exodus, and there's a madness to my motive, or a motive to my madness. This is highlights in Exodus, and it's titled The Appointment. In our last presentation in Exodus, titled The Life and Wife of Moses, we'd also taken some time discussing the Tel Elamana tablets, which contain a cache of correspondence from the various rulers of the city-states of Canaan, most of them written to the Egyptian pharaoh Akhenaten. This was expedient to do since in our first presentation, The Exodus in Controversy and History, we discussed inscriptions left behind by his immediate predecessor, Amenhotep III, which mentioned a people whom he had described as the nomads of Yahweh, the Shasu, if you will, of Yahweh, and as having been in the land of Canaan in his time. We have dated the Exodus event to about 1450 BC. Amenhotep III ruled Egypt from about 1391 to 1353 BC, and Akhenaten from about 1353 to 1336 BC. According to the general chronologies, which sometimes differ by a few years. So after 40 years of wandering in the desert of Sinai, the children of Israel, the only group who could possibly have been called the nomads of Yahweh, are in Canaan, which is consistent with the biblical account of the book of Joshua. Then sometime later, the rulers of the various cities in Canaan are appealing to help from Egypt to ward off the invading Hapiru, or Habiru, a group which academic scholars are resistant to identifying as Hebrews. In spite of the consistency of the reports in the Amarna tablets with the events recorded in the books of Joshua and the early chapters of Judges. So we would assert that the academic scholars have an agenda, that the Hebrew are none other than Joshua's Hebrews, and that this timeline and narrative makes evident the absolute historicity of the biblical accounts of the events which had followed the Exodus. We would also assert that the only way that Amenhotep III could have even been familiar with the name of Yahweh is because the Exodus event itself, must have made a lasting impression on the Egyptians, giving them strong reasons to remember that name. We shall discuss that further when Moses faces the Pharaoh of his time, who we esteem to have been Thutmose III. He ruled Egypt from 1479 to 1425 BC, and he was the great-grandfather of Amenhotep III. Now we are at a point in Exodus where we shall focus on the scripture, although there will be further archaeological or historical references at a few points in the balance of this book. For that, we also have a long digression at the very end of this chapter to discuss the person and nature of this pharaoh, for reasons I will clarify later. We shall evade all of the claims of the various charlatans, such as Ron Wyatt, who never found an Egyptian chariot wheel, or other claims regarding a Red Sea crossing far south of where it actually could have happened, and take a more pragmatic approach to interpreting the text. While the archaeology is an important contribution to understanding the historicity of the Exodus account, there are other ways to prove to oneself that the Bible is true even without archaeology. In fact, Christians professed faith in the scriptures for 1800 years before the birth of modern archaeology. But the Bible is not true if one insists that it is a history of the whole world and every race which dwells upon it. Scripture is only true and consistent from Genesis through to Revelation once it becomes evident that it is only dealing with one race of people, the creation of Adam, as opposed to other races which were already here, and that the concern of Yahweh God for that one race was narrowed, first to the sons of Noah, after the other descendants of Adam had been destroyed, and then to Abraham alone and the seed of the promise which would come out of his loins through Isaac and then Jacob. While the proof of this view is evident throughout the words of the prophets and the New Testament, there is also a significant example right here in Exodus chapter 2 in a lesson which is conveyed in the early life of Moses so far as it is related in Scripture. Only one incident in the early life of Moses is related in Scripture, which is what happened when Moses saw an Egyptian beating one of the Hebrews and the necessary events which followed thereafter. He killed the Egyptian, buried him in the sand, but the Hebrews themselves were going to tell on him, were going to rat him out, which is absolutely crazy. It's Stockholm Syndrome, I guess. According to the Exodus timeline, Moses was 40 years old when he fled Egypt. And only this one event which led him to do so is recorded here from his long life. A life which must have been eventful, since throughout those 40 years, he was living as a son in the household of a quite powerful king. As we had already discussed in our last presentation, the martyr Stephen had given a description of this one event in the life of Moses in Acts chapter 7. But Paul, describing the walk of the faith exhibited by various biblical figures throughout history, had said of Moses in part in Hebrews chapter 11, "By faith Moses, becoming full grown, refused to be called a son of the daughter of Pharaoh, rather preferring to be mistreated with the people of Yahweh than to have the temporary rewards of error, having esteemed the reproach of the anointed greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, since he had regard for the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the temper of the king, since seeing the invisible, he persevered." So Paul professed to have understood the motivation of Moses for what he had done. But so did Stephen, where he had attested in Acts chapter 7, for he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. Perhaps those men had more information than we have available today. However, the point is clear, and it is evident in Exodus chapter 2, that Moses had more regard for his own oppressed people than he had for the high status which he had enjoyed as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. So we would assert that because Moses loved his own people even more than he had himself, for that reason, he was qualified and chosen by Yahweh to lead his people out of Egypt. But this also speaks to the value of the life of the Egyptian in the eyes of God. In order to reward Moses for this act, by giving him a much greater responsibility as leader of his people, Yahweh God himself must have also valued the lives of the children of Israel above those of the Egyptians. So in the eyes of God, all people are not the same. The Egyptian was a fellow Adamic man of the race of Mitzrayim through Ham. There was a law in Genesis chapter 9 that anyone who killed such a man would pay for it with his own life. But what Moses had done was never considered murder in the eyes of God, and instead, he was rewarded for his deed. This, of course, should stand as a lesson for us all today. We should all wish to be like Moses. With that, we should also repeat the fact that Moses was not a race mixer, which is something that the modern denominational churches routinely accuse him of doing. As we had discussed, Moses actually married a remote cousin, a descendant of Midian, one of the sons which Abraham had with Keturah. While the later Midianites became adversaries to the children of Israel, and while they had also followed in the fornication of the surrounding nations, so they were ultimately rejected. But that was not the situation at the time when Moses went to Midian, where he had found a wife. So now we shall commence with Exodus chapter 3, where Moses is still in Midian. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. Mount Horeb seems to have been another name for Sinai, as the Brown Driver Briggs lexicon also attests. Where it is defined as desert or waste. Sinai is generally defined as meaning thorny. Of course, both descriptions are most likely true. Several times in Deuteronomy and elsewhere, the name Horeb is used synonymously for Sinai, such as in Deuteronomy chapter 5, where we read, Yahweh our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Exodus account is very clear that that covenant was made at Sinai. Then in Deuteronomy chapter 29, these are the words of the covenant which Yahweh commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. Then later in the psalm, in the 106th psalm, they made a calf in Horeb and worshiped the molten image. Thus they changed their glory into the similitude of an ox that eats grass. And then in Malachi chapter 4, remember ye the law of Moses my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. Of course, there are several other examples. So once again, this is further evidence that the wife of Moses was not an Ethiopian from Africa, but it simply dwelt in lands in Arabia which were associated with the tribes of Cush, who had dwelt there for many centuries before Midian was even born. In scripture, it is also not unusual that places had two different names, and both were known and used by the Israelites. The area of Horeb was within reasonable proximity to Egypt, Sheba, and other tribes of Cush, to Edom and the Horites, whom Esau had joined himself to, who were Canaanites, and also to Midian, Ishmael, and other tribes. So it is quite possible that some of these tribes used one name in reference to the place, and others used the other name. Horeb is a specific name, and it is not used elsewhere in Scripture as a general word for desert, for which there are other Hebrew terms. Verse 2 of Exodus chapter 3. And the angel of Yahweh appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. This apparent fire in the bush here is called the angel of Yahweh. But in the subsequent verses, it is Yahweh God himself who is said to have been doing the speaking, and who attests to having come down to deliver Israel from the Egyptians. But we would insist that there is no contradiction here. An angel is simply a messenger or representative. It need not even be a person. And the text is not insisting that there is a person here, referring to an entity with a human body. Often angels are persons. However, here the fire itself, the apparent burning in the bush, is the angel. So we would insist that the burning in the bush is the way in which Yahweh had chosen at this time to manifest himself to Moses. Yahweh being invisible, and men frequently needing physical manifestations in order to understand the actual presence of something, such as a spirit, chose to represent his presence with this burning in the bush. That may be called an angel, but in this instance, it is also a representative of the physical presence of God, so that Moses could understand that God is present. Often in Genesis, God had spoken to men in visions, but this time he chose something of greater substance. Verse 3. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. And when Yahweh saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Where we read, and Yahweh saw that he turned aside to see. Of course, Moses very likely did not record the event until sometime later. But this is how he remembered it, that the angel burning in the bush had represented the presence of Yahweh God himself, who was also manifest in the voice which he had heard. Verse 5. And he said, Draw not nigh hither. Draw not, or come not near this place. Put off thy shoes from thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. This incident is also recollected by Stephen in his account of Moses in Acts chapter 7. And the concept of holy ground appears again in Joshua chapter 5. So in Joshua we read, And it came to pass, when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him, with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went unto him and said unto him, Art thou for us or for our adversaries? And he said, Nay. But as captain of the host of Yahweh am I now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship, and said unto him, What saith my Lord unto his servant? And the captain of Yahweh's host said unto Joshua, Loose thy shoe from off thy foot, for the place whereon thou standest is holy. And Joshua did so. This happened as Joshua had the city of Jericho under siege, and the walls of the city would fall in a miraculous manner. So it seems that this captain of the host of Yahweh must have been an angel sent by God, who seemed to have both assisted and tried the humility of Joshua. Therefore, perhaps we may interpret the attribution of holy ground as a reference to the proximity of the presence of Yahweh God and also of his angels. However, when the angels of God who were sent to destroy Sodom had consorted and dined or lodged with Abraham and later with Lot, they did not insist that those men remove their shoes. So perhaps Moses was also told to remove his shoes as a demonstration of humility, which Moses displays in other ways as this account proceeds. In verse 6, "Moreover," he said, "I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And this informs us that Moses, once he was told these things, believed that to look upon the burning in the bush was to look upon God, for reason that he hid his face. So Moses was curious of the burning in the bush. But once he found it was God, or it represented God, he was too humble and feared to look at it any longer. This also indicates that it was information which Jacob had passed down to his sons concerning Yahweh, his God. The God who saw him through all of the trials which he had faced in Paddan Aram and later in Canaan. Jacob must also have passed down the experiences of his fathers, since Moses had recorded so many of them in Genesis. But we cannot rule out the possibility that at least some of the patriarchs had also kept journals. The keeping of journals in ancient Egypt is documented in works such as the Story of Senuhe, an Egyptian court officer in the 12th dynasty of Egypt and the rule of Pharaoh Senuset or Senusret I, who came to rule about 1962 BC, which by our chronology is just a few years before the birth of Abraham. Senuhe was a court officer who fled Egypt, lived for a time in Syria, and was eventually returned and restored to his original status. The account is also valuable for its description of the Levant at that time. While most of the surviving journals uncovered by archaeologists in Mesopotamia were kept for purely business reasons, the Egyptian Senuhe is an example of a journal, I should say the Egyptian story of Senuhe, is an example of a journal kept for personal or biographical reasons. Verse 7. Exodus chapter 3. "And Yahweh said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people, which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters. For I know their sorrows, and I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land unto a good land and large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come unto me, And I've also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppress them. Of course, this would mark a return to the same land which had already been promised to Abraham forever from as early as Genesis chapter 15, where the foreboding the captivity in Egypt, Yahweh had told Abraham in part, and also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace, thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. And it came to pass that when the sun went down, and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace, and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. In the same day Yahweh made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Cabanites, and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Rephaim, and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Girgashites and the Jebusites. Now Moses receives an explicit appointment. Come now, therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. This appointment is the entire reason why Yahweh had appeared to Moses here. And we have already seen how Moses was qualified for the position, both in his education and in his love for his people, upon whom he had placed a much greater value than the status which he himself had in the household of the Pharaoh. So Moses was qualified for this appointment, not only because he loved his people, but because on their account, he denied himself. He denied his own life and loved his people selflessly. This is what Christ himself had meant when we read in Luke chapter 9. And he said to them all, speaking to his disciples, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. At this time, Moses is about 80 years old, and he has spent 40 years in exile on account of the fact that he denied himself. But as we had demonstrated in our Genesis commentary, Jacob was 70 years old when he first went to Haran for a wife and ended up staying there nearly 20 years working in the fields and having 13 children with four wives. Actually, he only had 12 children in Haran. Benjamin was born a little later. But I'm not changing my notes. Unlike Esau, Jacob lived in self-denial, never having sought the pleasure of a woman on his own, but awaiting the instructions of Isaac, his father. His father Isaac denied himself when he was laid on the altar for sacrifice, and he never protested his father's actions. Abraham also denied himself, as he was evidently a wealthy man living among his own people, and gave that up in obedience to God, who told him to leave his ancestral town and move to Canaan at the age of 75, to live as a stranger wandering among an accursed people. Yahweh would sustain Moses in his later years, just as he had sustained Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which he promises as the dialogue here continues. Now Moses, in yet another expression of his humility, questions God and asks how he is worthy of this appointment. And Moses said unto God, "Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh, and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" And he said, meaning God said, "Certainly I will be with thee, and this shall be a token unto thee, that I have sent thee. When thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain." And here we see that Horeb certainly is the same place as Sinai. In the opening verse of this chapter, Horeb was referred to as the mountain of God. But that label must have been applied by Moses much later when he wrote this account, because of the experiences which he had with God on this mountain, both here and in the later chapters of Exodus. As we proceed, it is evident that Moses had accepted this answer, and the appointment for the task upon which he was about to embark. Moses, like Abraham before him, had accepted this task solely upon the word of God, without having seen any of his mighty works or his ability to actually deliver, although the burning in the bush must have been a significant apparition. Another advantage which Moses had that Abraham did not have were the reports of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which must have been made in reference to this God and handed down to their sons, whether it was in a journal format or whether it was vocally, orally, by word of mouth, really doesn't matter. Verse 13, "And Moses said unto God, Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, and shall say unto them, The God of your fathers has sent me unto you. And they shall say to me, What is his name? What shall I say unto them?" This is a reasonable request, even if such a demand had not been made by the patriarchs down through the time of Jacob. For Jacob, it was enough to hear the words, "I am the God of Abraham, thy father," as we see in Genesis chapter 26. "And Yahweh appeared unto him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham, thy father. Fear not, for I am with thee, and I will bless thee, and multiply thy seed for my servant Abraham's sake." Nevertheless, Yahweh accommodates Moses, who would at least have something by which to refer to this God, in verse 14. "And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, Thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, I am has sent me unto you." And here, and this might be easier to follow in print than in speech, but I'm going to try. Here we have a phrase in which the Hebrew reads, Ahaya, Ashar, Ahaya, and which is translated in the King James Version as, I am that I am, but in the New American Standard Bible as, I am who I am. The connecting word, ashar, is a particle of relation, which may be translated as there, where, or who, among other words, depending upon its context. The Septuagint translators rendered the Hebrew phrase in Greek as ego eimi ho own. And that ego is the Greek word for I. And eimi is the first person present form of the verb, which means to be. So it means I am. I am is ego, I, me. That's technically, I mean, it's translated I am. And the redundancy in Greek is accepted. But it's really I am. And ho own is that ho, it's an article, a relative pronoun. So it's he who. And I often translate it as he who in the Christogene New Testament in relation to particles such as this. Own is a particle form of I, me. Particles, of course, have no person, like first person, second person, third person. It's a particle form. It's masculine and singular, and it just means being in the present tense. Being. I am he who is being. But Brenton had translated it as I am the being, interpreting ho as a definite article, which is fine. And that's a fair interpretation. But I would rather write I am he who is, reflecting on the masculine gender of the final words in the phrase. I am he who be. I am he who is being. It's clumsy to pronounce, to translate that perfectly into English and capture the exact sense of each word. But basically, it's I am that I am, or I am who I am. And Yahweh is saying that to Moses. So we have to understand that I am, that is first person form of the verb. And I'm going to explain that momentarily. But from our perspective, addressing Yahweh or describing Yahweh, we cannot use that first person form. We have to use the second person form. We have to change the I to a he. And Moses, or Yahweh himself, actually, as it's recorded in Genesis, and I'm sorry, in Exodus chapter 3, Yahweh himself does that same thing when he tells Moses what to say to the people. And we will get to that. So the other word, which appears twice, Ahaya, Ashar, Ahaya. So Ashar is who or that. And this word Ahaya appears twice, and that's spelled with an aleph, a hey or h, a yod or y, and a hey or h. So we see that pattern of two heys that we see in the Tetragrammaton, which is yod, hey, vowel, hey, and I will also explain that. So it's sort of the same pattern with the two letter h's, but that middle letter is a yod instead of a vav, as it is in the Tetragrammaton, and there is also an explainable reason for that. So that prefix, the aleph prefix, is important here. Ahaya is a phrase formed by prefixing the particle a or aleph to the word haya. The A or Aleph as a prefix means I in English. So when you put it before a verb, you prefix it to a verb like Haya, it means I am in English. The word Haya has a wide range of meanings to the point where its definition consumes four full pages. Dense pages in the Brown Driver Briggs lexicon of the Hebrew language. Among them are to happen, to come to pass, to become or to be, or to come into being. At the beginning of their definition, they explain that Haya is a parallel form of Hawa, which is hey, vav, hey, yod, hey, and some people say wow, WAW or VAV, V-A-V. And that's the same in Latin. The U and the V are basically the same character in Latin. They're the same character in Hebrew. And the U is often pronounced like a W. So it's a W or a V in Hebrew. So we see that pattern now of the Tetragrammaton. Hey, thou, hey, they're the final three letters of the Tetragrammaton. So keep that in mind. So if you prefix that with an A, it's I am. As a phrase, prefixing it with an Aleph in Hebrew. So with great simplicity, here we would assert that the Tetragrammaton is formed by Moses, or perhaps by Yahweh himself in his instructions to Moses at the end of this chapter. When the pronoun particle at the beginning of the phrase, Ahaya, is converted to the second person by changing the prefix to a yod. When you put a yod in front of a verb in Hebrew, it means he. So I am, if you drop the aleph and add a yod as a prefix, it doesn't mean I am any longer. It means he is. So with the initial form of this verb, which is used here, the hey, yod, hey, if we wrote aleph, hey, yod, hey, it's a haya, that's I am. If we drop the aleph and add a yod instead, it spells yahaya, but the alternate spelling of the verb was also employed in the Tetragrammaton. Hey, vav, hey, instead of hey, yad, hey, which is hawa rather than haya. And adding the yad to the front of that, it spells yad, hey, vav, hey, which is the Tetragrammaton. The familiar spelling of it, which we know as Yahweh. Of course, Yahweh referred to himself when he said, I am that I am, but from the perspective of men, the pronoun would have to be changed to a yod from an aleph to refer to Yahweh. Yes, I'm sorry, the yod is he, that's a third person pronoun, it's not a second person pronoun, so I screwed that up, that's okay. Thank you. Somebody in the chat checking me. But that's good. I like that. Okay. So third person, he. If we are referring to God, first person, I, if God is referring to himself, where he wrote, I am that I am, or said, I am that I am, that's first person. That's God speaking of himself. Where Moses wrote his name, he didn't write it in the first person. He had to write it in the third person. He is what he is. If we spell the Tetragrammaton, which Yahweh gave us in Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, according to Moses, then we have to change that aleph to a yod in order to refer to him, because we aren't saying his name. With I, then we're referring to ourselves. So this is really, really simple. It's not, and I sat this morning and figured all this out myself, even though I had suspected it in the past. I wrote it all out myself, and there are articles, and some of those articles are on our websites, Clifton's article, which is at Lord or Yahweh, where the Encyclopedia Britannica really, really belabors this issue, and it's unnecessary. This is, to me, it's really simple. Why Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh means he is, but Yahweh called himself the I am because he spoke in the first person rather than in the third. It's really simple. And to create that third person phrase is not difficult at all. You could verify what I'm saying with Brown Driver Briggs lexicon in 5 minutes flat. Except that you also have to get a resource for Hebrew prefixes and suffixes, which are, there are several good ones on the internet. Just search for Hebrew prefixes, suffixes, and you'll find them. And they'll explain to you that an aleph before a verb means I, and a yod before a verb means he. And there are other letters put before verbs which mean other things, even she. Okay. In Strong's original concordance, the Tetragrammaton is found at its own entry, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, or Yahweh at number 3068. And he transliterates it as Jehovah. And he acknowledged that the root of the word is Haya, or Hey Yod Hey. Seeing that the alternate spelling of Hawa was evidently chosen by Moses to represent the name, affixed with the prefix meaning he, it is easy to see how the form Jehovah came into use in English. However, I would prefer the testimony of Flavius Josephus, who had explained, writing in Greek, that the name of God is spelled with four vowels. With four Greek vowels, we can spell Yahweh, but not Jehovah. However, it seems that vowel sounds were uttered in spoken Hebrew according to some colloquial usage of words, rather than by any strict grammatical rules. We may never know because true Hebrew has not been spoken for many centuries. So we can only use what we can approximate from what little information we have. And no, I do not trust Hebrew as it's taught by Jews, who basically made up a lot of things Hebrew and piled in a lot of Yiddish words from German, from Polish, from Russian into the language that they call Hebrew today. It's not Hebrew. It's half made up. The vowel points in the Masoretic text, the vowel points around letters, they're also an invention, a contrivance of the Talmudists. The Talmudic rabbis of the 3rd and 4th centuries, they're not original. So when I examine Hebrew, I ignore the vowel points. I ignore Yiddish. I ignore Jewish commentators. I don't care about them. Okay, Exodus chapter 3, verse 15. And God said moreover unto Moses, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, Yahweh, and there it's spelled Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. So that tetragrammaton first appears in the mouth of God, according to Moses, the way he wrote this verse. Yahweh, God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial to all generations. So here we may perceive that Yahweh God does not really have a name, as we know names, special labels identifying certain unique things or individuals. Rather, he chose to simply refer to himself as he who is, or as the Septuagint has it, the being, the I am. No man can make such a claim, since man is vanity, and all men come to the point where they are not. But God is, God was, and God shall be, as he is not vanity, and he shall not die. So we read in the declaration of Yahshua Christ in Revelation chapter 1, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, saith the Lord, which is and which was and which is to come, the Almighty. Where he said, and which was, it does not mean that somehow he was not at some point in time. Rather, it means that he is the God of yesterday, as well as the God of the remote past when he dealt with our fathers, and the God of the even more remote past when he created the earth and the things in it. And he is also the God of now, as well as the God of the future. So he is. And that is the most basic interpretation of his name, Yahweh. Not only was Moses appointed here at Horeb at the burning bush, but God appointed the name by which his people should know and address him. And that name is a simple and humble phrase declaring his existence. That's all it is. He needs three letters, I am, or we need four, he is, to name our God, where these earthly kings love 50 different titles and all kinds of fake names and bullshit to try to create their own majesty. I think it's funny, right? I'm sorry. Now Moses is told how to begin the execution of his appointed task. Go and gather the elders of Israel together. It's not something you do in a day. It's a long trip. And say unto them, Yahweh, God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, appeared unto me, saying, I have surely visited you and seen that which is done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt unto the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites unto a land flowing with milk and honey. Milk. They can't be Jews. They drink milk and they're promised milk. Plenty of it. This is a repeat of the words which Yahweh had spoken to Moses earlier in the chapter in verse 8. But the context is different, so the repetition is necessitated. In verse 8, Yahweh expressed his own intent, which here in verse 17, he is instructing Moses to relate that directly to the elders of Israel. Perhaps this would also give Moses credibility when he does speak to the elders, since he would appear to be an outsider, but they should have been able to recall the promises and other things passed down to them from their fathers. In other words, they should recognize this promise of the lands of these Canaanite tribes, because Yahweh had promised that to Abraham many years before. Where the next verse opens, Yahweh God expresses with confidence that the elders would indeed listen to and obey Moses. It is possible, but not certain, that at least some of them had heard of Moses. Verse 18. And they shall hearken to thy voice, and thou shalt come, thou and the elders of Israel, unto the king of Egypt, and ye shall say unto him, Yahweh, God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And now let us go, we beseech thee, 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to Yahweh our God. So Moses is told by Yahweh to use his name, the Tetragrammaton, which we pronounce as Yahweh, when communicating with the Pharaoh, something which he must have done, since perhaps 50 or 60 years later, Pharaoh Amenhotep III, the great-grandson of the Pharaoh of the time of Moses, who is Thutmose III, remembered that name and described Israel as the Shasu of Yahweh, dwelling in the land of Canaan. Of course, the Pharaoh of Egypt was a very proud man. So Yahweh also knew with confidence how he would react to the request of Moses. And I'll read verses 19 through 22. And make short of them, but I have a long historical explanation explaining that the person and nature and accomplishments of this Pharaoh, the Pharaoh of the Exodus, who must be Thutmose III. Verse 19. And I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go. No, not by a mighty hand. And I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in the midst thereof. And after that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall come to pass that when you go, you shall not go empty. But every woman shall borrow from her neighbor, and of her that sojourns in her house, jewels of silver, and jewels of gold, and raiment. And you shall put them on your sons and upon your daughters, and you shall spoil the Egyptians. Here, in order to illustrate the type of man that Thutmose III, the Pharaoh of the Exodus, had been, I'm going to cite a lengthy section of an article from Britannica, which I think is a fair evaluation of the history of the period. Other sources are not so accurate concerning Hatshepsut, and still others glorify Thutmose III to a much greater extent. The subject of this article is the period called the Egyptian New Kingdom, and it begins with the 18th dynasty. The first two pharaohs of this dynasty were Amos, who drove out the Hyksos rulers of Lower Egypt, and Amenhotep I, who began to expand the borders of Egypt. After him, the next rulers are as follows, Thutmose I and Thutmose II. And we read, lacking a surviving heir, Amenhotep I was succeeded by one of his generals, Thutmose I, who ruled from 1493 to 1483 BC, who married his own full sister, Amos. So she was also, I had mentioned a few weeks ago that the most names, Thutmose, Kamos, Amos, appeared sometimes on both males and females. So this is one example of that. But this isn't even in a royal household. This is in one of the Egyptian generals who's high ranking, but he's still just a military officer. He might be a loose relationship to the household. And his own sister is married, is named Amos, after the first pharaoh of the dynasty, and he married her, his full sister, which didn't seem to be a problem in Egypt for some strange reason. In the south, Thutmose destroyed the Karma state. He inscribed a rock as a boundary marker, later confirmed by Thutmose III, near Kenesa Kirgis, north of the Fifth Cataract. He then executed a brilliant campaign into Syria and crossed across the Euphrates River, and he erected a victory stela near Carchemish. Thus, in the reign of Thutmose I, Egyptian conquests in the Middle East and Africa reached their greatest extent, but they may not yet have been firmly held. His little-known successor, Thutmose II, who only ruled for 2 years, 1482 to 1480, apparently continued his policies. Now we move on to Thutmose II's successors. Hatshepsut was his daughter, and Thutmose III. I'm sorry. Hatshepsut was Thutmose I's daughter and Thutmose II's younger sister. At Thutmose II's death, his queen and sister, Hatshepsut, had only a young daughter, but a minor wife had borne him a boy, who was apparently very young at his accession. His son, Thutmose III, who ruled from 1479 to 1425 BC, later reconquered Egypt's Asian Empire and became an outstanding ruler. During his first few regnal years, Thutmose III theoretically controlled the land, but Hatshepsut governed as regent, an adult placed over a minor, a king that's too young to actually act as king. According to one version of the event, the Oracle of Amon, sometime between Thutmose III's second and seventh regnal years, so he's still very young, she assumed the kingship herself. According to one version of the event, the Oracle of Amon proclaimed her king at Karnak, where she was crowned. So that's propaganda, or she paid off a priest. A more propagandistic account, preserved in texts and reliefs of her splendid mortuary temple at Deir al-Babri, ignores the reign of Thutmose II and asserts that her father, Thutmose I, proclaimed her his successor. Power grab by a uber-feminist woman. Upon becoming king, Hatshepsut became the dominant partner in a joint rule that lasted until her death in about 1458 BC. There are monuments dedicated by Hatshepsut that depict both kings. She had the support of various powerful personalities. The most notable among them was Senenmut, the steward and tutor of her daughter Neferuri. Installing herself king, Hatshepsut adopted the royal titulary, but avoided the epithet Mighty Bull, all the royal titles. And she avoided Mighty Bull. She was a dyke, but not a bull dyke, I guess. I'm kind of kidding, but I'm just criticizing her feminism. That epithet, Mighty Bull, was regularly employed by other kings. Although in her release she was depicted as a male, pronominal references in the texts usually reflect her womanhood. Similarly, much of her statuary shows her in male form, but there are rarer examples that render her as a woman. In less formal documents, she was referred to as the king's great wife, that is, queen, while Thutmose III was king. There is thus a certain ambiguity in the treatment of Hatshepsut as king. Her temple reliefs depict pacific, meaning peaceful, enterprises, such as the transporting of obelisks for Amon's temple and a commercial expedition to Punt. Her art style looked back to Middle Kingdom ideals. Some warlike scenes are depicted, however, and she may have waged a campaign in Nubia. In one inscription, she blamed the Hyksos for the supposedly poor state of the land before her rule, even though they had been expelled from the region more than a generation earlier. During Hatshepsut's ascendancy, Egypt's position in Asia may have deteriorated because of the expansion of Mitannian power in Syria. Mitannian being a reference to the Mitanni kingdom, which was an Amorite kingdom in northern Syria that was powerful for about 250 years. Shortly after her death, the prince of the Syrian city of Kadesh stood with troops of 330 princes of a Syro-Palestinian coalition at Megiddo. Such a force was more than merely defensive. and the intention may have been to advance against Egypt. The 330 must have represented all the places of any size in the region that were not subject to Egyptian rule, and maybe a schematic figure derived from a list of place names. It is noteworthy that Mitanni itself was not directly involved. Thutmose III proceeded to Gaza with his army, and then to Yehem, subjugating rebellious Palestinian towns along the way. His annals relate how, at a consultation concerning the best route over the Mount Carmel Ridge, the king overruled his officers and selected a shorter but more dangerous route through the Aruna Pass and then led the troops himself. The march went smoothly, and when the Egyptians attacked at dawn, they prevailed over the enemy troops and besieged Megiddo. Thutmose III, meanwhile, coordinated the landing of other army divisions on the Syro-Palestinian littoral on the beach, whence they proceeded inland, so that the strategy resembled a pincer technique. The siege ended in a treaty by which Syrian princes swore an oath of submission to the king, to the pharaoh, Thutmose III. As was normal in ancient diplomacy and in Egyptian practice, the oath was binding only upon those who swore it, not upon future generations. By the end of the first campaign, Egyptian domination extended northward to a line linking Byblos and Damascus, although the Prince of Kadesh remained to be vanquished. Assyria sent lapis lazuli as tribute. Asian princes surrendered their weapons, including a large number of horses and chariots. Thutmose III took only a limited number of captives. He appointed Asian princes to govern the towns and took their brothers and sons to Egypt, where they were educated at the court. The Romans later did the same thing, so did the Babylonians, the Persians. Most eventually returned home to serve as loyal vassals, though some remained in Egypt at court. In order to ensure the loyalty of Asian city-states, Egypt maintained garrisons that could quell insurrection and supervise the delivery of tribute. There never was an elaborate Egyptian imperial administration in Asia. They relied on their subject states to administer themselves. Thutmose III conducted numerous subsequent campaigns in Asia. The submission of Kadesh was finally achieved. But Thutmose III's ultimate aim was the defeat of Mitanni. He used the navy to transport troops to Asian coastal towns, avoiding arduous overland marches around Carchemish, avoiding arduous overland marches from Egypt. His great eighth campaign led him across the Euphrates. Although the countryside around Carchemish was ravaged, the city was not taken, and a Mitannian prince was able to flee. The psychological gain of this campaign was perhaps greater than its military success for Babylonia, Assyria, and the Hittites. All sent tribute in recognition of Egyptian dominance. Although Thutmose III never subjugated Mitanni, he placed Egypt's conquests on a firm footing by constant campaigning that contrasts with the forays of his predecessors. Thutmose III's annals, inscribed in the Temple of Karnak, are remarkably succinct and accurate. But his other texts, particularly one set in his newly founded Nubian capital of Napata, are more conventional in their rhetoric. He seems to have married three Syrian wives, probably three Canaanite wives, which may represent diplomatic unions, marking Egypt's entry into the realm of international affairs of the ancient Middle East. Thutmose III initiated a truly imperial Egyptian rule in Nubia. Much of the land became estates of institutions in Egypt, while local cultural traits disappeared from the archaeological record. Sons of chiefs were educated at the Egyptian court, so I guess the niggers themselves did not disappear. A few returned to Nubia to serve as administrators, and some were buried there in Egyptian fashion. Nubian fortresses lost their strategic value and became administrative centers. Open towns developed around them, and in several temples outside their walls, the cult of the divine king was established. We see a cult of the emperor later in Rome. Lower Nubia supplied gold from the desert and hard and semi-precious stones. From farther south came tropical African woods, perfumes, oil, ivory, animal skins, and ostrich plumes. There is scarcely any trace of local population from the later New Kingdom, when many more temples were built in Nubia. By the end of the 20th dynasty, the region had almost no prosperous settled population. Under Thutmose III, the wealth of the empire became apparent in Egypt. Many temples were built, and vast sums were donated to the estate of Amon-Re. There were many tombs of his high officials at Thebes. The capital had been moved to Memphis. That's very important in this Exodus account. But Thebes remained a religious center. Now, some sources say that Thebes remained the administrative center and that only a military capital and the home of the pharaoh were set up in Memphis. So the reports diverge on that. The campaigns of kings such as Thutmose III required a large military establishment, including a hierarchy of officers and an expensive chariotry. The king grew up with military companions whose close connection with him enabled them to participate increasingly in government. Military officers were appointed to high civil and religious positions, and by the Ramesside period, the time of Ramses, which is probably 100 years later. No, I'm sorry, closer to 200 years later. And by the Ramesside period, the influence of such people had come to outweigh that of the traditional bureaucracy. It is significant to understanding the Exodus account that Thutmose III had relocated his capital to Memphis. Since the time of the pharaoh of Joseph, in the middle of the 13th dynasty, the Egyptian capital was moved far south to Thebes to escape the incursions of the Hyksos. So Egypt was divided into several parts, with different dynasties of pharaohs ruling each of them. The 15th dynasty was the Hyksos dynasty in Lower Egypt. The 13th dynasty was at Thebes. They retreated from the Delta area. And there was a 17th dynasty and also some other dynasty, I forget which one, that ruled other portions that were formerly all of United Egypt. I discussed that in the Genesis commentary, but I don't have all the details in my head. I'm sorry. I can't possibly keep them all there. Okay. So Egypt was divided into several parts with different dynasties of pharaohs ruling each of them. But Amos, the first pharaoh of the 18th dynasty, reunified all of Egypt under his own rule. During the time of the division, the children of Israel were settled in Goshen, which is where the later city Pi Ramses, which they had been forced to build, was also situated. During this period, they were under the rule of the 15th dynasty of Hyksos rulers. The capital of Egypt, Thebes, was 350 miles from Goshen by air. It would have been quite a burden for Moses to travel over 700 miles each time he went from Goshen to see the Pharaoh. But the ruins of ancient Memphis are located near the modern village of Mitrahina, which is about 12 miles south of Cairo on the west bank of the Nile River. This site is only about 75 miles from Goshen by air. So Moses had to travel 75 miles, or a little longer on the ground, each time he had gone to address the Pharaoh. It is highly plausible that he traveled by boat, since both locations were within reasonable distance of the Nile River and its branches in the Delta. Sources state that this move of the capital happened around 1457 BC. That would be a year after the death of Hatshepsut and only a few years before the main event of the Exodus. As for Thutmose III, he had been a king or joint ruler along with his older sister for nearly all of his life. He was at the height of his power by 1450 BC and the time of the Exodus. He had many military victories, which resulted in extending Egyptian power as far as Carchemish on the Euphrates River in far northwestern Syria. Here he was described as having outgeneraled his generals. His victory brought him tribute from some of the most powerful nations of his time, the Hittites and the Assyrians. The Hittites and the Assyrians probably saw Thutmose as an important ally in the Mitanni thirst for power. At the time, the Kassites, who came to rule Babylon, sometime after the fall of the Babylonian Empire of the Amorites, had only marginal power, but it was nevertheless significant for Thutmose to receive tribute from them also. The Kassites never exerted power outside of their area in Babylonia, in southern Mesopotamia. And they lasted about 500 years there, autonomously. Okay. With all of this, Thutmose III was a very proud man. He had every reason to be a very proud man. He was a very powerful king. And that is how he is characterized here in the Exodus. And that closes this portion of our commentary on highlights in Exodus. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night.